Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
With you at The Positive Mind here in WBAI. 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, things to think about. And we have been talking for a number of weeks about human evolution. And we used human sexuality and the development of human sexuality as a way of watching human evolution and how humans evolved. Of course, it makes sense, doesn't it, that the first rule of evolution is survival of the species. So there we were trying to tell you how the species decided that it was going to best survive by shaping human sexuality. We talked about a bottleneck in 150,000 years. Was it 150,000 or 450,000?
It was 144,000, something like that.
Give or take
right.
A few hundred thousand.
Right.
Years ago, where we almost didn't make it, where humans kind of ran into this problem, which was human heads were getting really big because humans were very intelligent, and the pelvises of young women were not big enough for the heads to pass through. Therefore, bodies were being found back in that time of stillborn babies because they didn't have any other way of having the babies. So there was this evolutionary conundrum, and all of a sudden, you know, humans had to decide to shape their sexuality to be different. You could learn more about that by hearing the other programs. Today we're going to look at something that is very important, because here we have tracked and looked at the similarities between humans and other animals in their survival response, in their sexuality. Humans and animals are very similar. Very similar, so much so that if you were to turn on Spring Break on TV and watch a teenage or a young college spring break, you'll see almost everything. It follows almost all the rules of animal mating behavior.
And that is because the chemistry behind it is the same. The chemicals are the same for animals as they are for humans. The hormones are the same. And brains are similar, especially in mammals and especially for the primates. Primates are very similar to humans, and yet there is a big difference.
Which we're going to talk about.
Which we're going to talk about.
The similarity in watching the program, you're going to see hormones, you're going to see a lot of testosterone running around the place and a lot of other chemicals. You're going to see the men competing with each other, young men, when hormones are truly raging, right? And you're going to see them competing and playing volleyball and seeing who's going to be the strongest. And then you're going to see the young women positioning themselves to attract the stronger male, the more desirable male. It's kind of obvious. It's kind of clear. But that's not enough of a story. Humans are not just animals. Even those humans have capacities that are different than all other animals before us. Humans have developed a convoluted, interesting word, a convoluted brain. We have a complex brain.
So if you take a piece of paper, Armand, and you crumple it up, that's pretty much what happens to the brain. The brain is a very large surface that has to be contained within a very small space. And so in order to do that, it's crumpled up. It's folded in upon itself. But in humans, the folds are deeper, the grooves are deeper. So the brain surface is much, much bigger. And the
Wait
connections...
Wait a minute, let me just get that for a minute. That's a very interesting visual, okay? So if you took a piece of... If you took a brain and you just had a flat surface like a globe, like a globe of the planet.
Right.
Now you have only the neurons to run around the outside of that. Now if you took it, and you took it like a piece of paper and crumpled it up, now you have all these little caverns inside you could go. And they're within the same amount of space being used, meaning you could only be using, you know, 14 inches of space. But there are so many convolutions.
Well, the brain of a human has deeper grooves, meaning that we have a bigger surface. that has to fit within that tiny space so that it has to be crumpled up deeper and the grooves are deeper. And that means it's more complex. And that means something, Armand, even in terms of perception. Actually, I think that's where we want to start from. We were looking at finding the best way to explain how humans are different from animals.
If you talk about a convoluted brain, and you talk about how complex it is and how much, you know, if you took a human brain and you took it out and you unfolded it like you would paper, which of course you can't, and you ironed it out, do you know you would have enough space to go from, you would get the brain of a, you get pretty...
You would get a lot of surface, yes. You would get an enormous amount of surface. I don't remember exactly what the footage would be, but it's huge because the human has invested during evolution in developing a brain that is its major advantage because it is able to perceive, I don't want to say better, but I want to say differently from any other creature in the universe.
Sure, because hawks will have better eyes and cheetahs will have better legs and, you know, and
sure,
other animals will have better perceptual hearing, but we have this complex system. Now, what's important about this? What's important about this is that the complexity of our mind enables us to develop a thing that we're going to find is what truly separates us. But let's go back for a minute to the evolution of human sexuality, and let's consider that it is the easiest thing to manipulate people, which is to control their sexuality. And by manipulate, I mean manipulate not just in a negative way. If you're a society, and you want to build your society, and you want to get more people, what do you want to do? You want to put rules on that tell people, don't have random sex. Right? This is one of the things. Don't have sex with your family, because that's going to weaken the species. Don't have sex with people who are too young. Don't have sex if it's going to wind up getting the family to come after you with a gun and shoot you. Right? Don't have sex with your partner's wife. Don't have sex with, you know, the guy who lives next door's wife. Don't have sex. A lot of sexual inhibitions. In fact, weren't you saying something about all rules?
Well, what I was saying was that because sexuality has been so central and such a powerful drive in human behavior, meaning that humans will often do things for in the name of mating that they will not do for any other reason, sexuality is such a powerful instinctual, hormonal, physiological urge, and humans are so sexual, humans are so compelled in their sexuality, it is so important in human beings, that laws and regulations of society have emerged as a way to control precisely the sexual behavior, especially of adult males. Young adult males can behave aggressively, can behave destructively, can behave in ways that are dangerous for the community. So a lot of the constrictions of society, the rules that have come up, the do's and don'ts, are really there in order to protect the community from the sexuality of young men.
So the rule is species first. The rule is, how are we going to get by? And let's develop rules around that. That's how this whole thing started 140,000 years ago. We made rules about sex for the first time.
Well, women started because mm-hmm. they were the ones dying. And what we said was that most likely it seems that women figured out the connection between mating, between sex, and having babies. And from there, we have come down history and we have explained the consequences of that realization and how it has affected, for instance, relationship between genders. Women took control in a sense of mating, in the sense that women had to protect themselves from mating in a way that could have killed them, and from mating too much, from mating and having too many babies, from mating when they're too young. So women took control, and that has set off a set of dynamics that have affected the genders, but then have affected all society.
And, it, you know, Roberta, it did one other thing. It was the very first complex thought. Do you know what I mean? In other words, this was not just set off rules about sex and society. It set off this idea that you could think, that you could project, that you could imagine.
It set off the idea that actions, events, could have a consequence in the future, so that the mind of the human became able to connect something that could happen or was about to happen in the present with something that could happen down the road. And that's something that animals cannot do.
Well, we're going to talk about animals now. I've got to go back to that for a minute, because many of you have your dog and your cat, and you say, my cat loves me, and my cat knows that I'm out, and my cat and I have a relationship, and my dog and I have a relationship. Let's talk about the animals and their perceptual ability. Okay? If you watch an animal in two places, being killed or having sex, you will find this kind of very unusual, surprising lack of understanding. Animals do not understand death. Animals do not understand sex as it relates to pregnancy.
Because animals do not understand that things happen in time. Animals only live in the present. The present is like a bubble that contains everything that there is. For an animal, there is nothing outside of that moment of perception. For an animal, there is nothing to worry about in the future or the past, because future and past don't exist. See, the brain of an animal is not able to accommodate the thought of the future or the past.
This is very important. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. In case you want to stop for a minute and just think about that. With an animal, there is no past, there is no future. Now you're going to say, oh, but what about the animals that get chestnuts and put them in the trees and save them for the next season?
That's instinctual, Armand. That's totally instinctual behavior.
They don't know why they're saving the nuts.
No.
They don't know that that little squirrel that's taking that thing and putting it down in its little castle keep, wherever it keeps it, or the burrow.
It's strange to think that they do not know, but they do not know. They do it because this is instinctual behavior, and then retrieving the nut is also instinctual, whereby the squirrel knows that the nut is there, but does not remember, does not make an association between having hidden the nut in that hole and now retrieving it. There's no connection between past and present or present and future for an animal.
This is very important, because this affects us, and it will help you appreciate humans in such a bigger way. When you get this, I mean, most people don't like to believe this. They like to create animals having very human qualities. You can watch an animal mourn. You can watch animals have emotions. You can watch an animal feel happy. You can watch all of these things. We're not saying animals don't have emotional feelings, reactions. I mentioned death. I have watched and seen, and we've all seen, a spider catching a mosquito, a fly. The animal will fight furiously against the spider as it is being wrapped or killed or eaten or whatever.
But that's the body of the animal that is fighting.
Not the mind.
Not the mind.
The mind of the animal, and you'll see this frequently when you look at films of the Serengeti, if you could stand to see them, when you see a wild animal being caught by a lion, the body may be fighting back, but the animal looks awestruck. In fact, nature makes it so that when the animal is about to die, it is flooded with endorphins, and it has no feeling.
The mind of the animal disengages the body, most likely, in the moment of such high stress. When the animal is being attacked, the electrical impulses that go through its nervous system are increased to such high voltage that there's a short circuit that happens whereby the mind is disconnected from the body. So that's why there's that confused look. The animal in that moment no longer can make sense of what's happening because it does not have a concept of dying. It does not know it's dying. It does not know what is happening. The mind disconnects from the body. The body continues to fight as the mind leaves and dissolves.
Now the animal fights and gets away.
Oh, and that's a different story.
Now let's say it gets away. Mm-hmm. Does it say, oh boy, I almost died?
No.
What does it say?
It doesn't say anything.
It says, you see those big characters with the big whiskers?
Stay away.
They could make pain for me. Mm-hmm. That's what it says. I've learned that.
But there's no connection between the event and future and past. Maybe the animal is wounded, so the animal instinctively will know to look for a hole and hide and eat certain foods or herbs, whatever, to cure itself. But all of that happens in a bubble that is only perceptive of the present. It does not draw conclusions. It does not imagine what could happen in the future. It does not do any of the things that the brain of the human being is able to do. Well, I should say the mind. But of course, the mind is so complex in the human because we have the perceptual capacity of a brain that is the most astounding structure in the universe that we know of.
So why is this important? Why is it important? Well, if you think of the mating behaviors of most animals, is an animal who is kind of, you know, if you watch them while they're having sex, if you've ever seen recently saw a photo of two kangaroos having sex. Did you see that?
No.
Two kangaroos having sex and a little boy is feeding the kangaroo on top.
Oh, yes, I have seen that, actually, yes.
You know, and you're feeding it, and so on one level he's eating, on the other level he's having sex, and there's no real connection. I mean, this is something that it's doing. Did that kangaroo lust for this other kangaroo? Did that kangaroo decide that this was going to be the kangaroo of its choice?
Well, it certainly has no concept that through that moment of mating, it will conceive. A kangaroo doesn't have a thought of having a baby while it's mating.
You know, when you said that the last time, we got so many letters of disagreement.
Oh, really?
Yeah, really. We got letters of disagreement. People believe that an animal will choose its mate according to its mate being the best to have as a mate, and then they believe that once they have sex, they are going to have pregnant. And most people believe that there's a willfulness between having sex and getting pregnant, that animals realize they're going to get pregnant if they have sex.
Oh, no, there is no such thing. An animal mates in the same way in which an animal eats or does any other thing to that is driven by the chemistry and the imperatives of the hormones. But when the animal is mating, there is a body sensation. There is a movement that accompanies the behavior. I'm sure that the sensation is increased, you know, in intensity from when the animal is not mating. So there's a change in the status of perception. But the animal is not thinking about having a baby.
And it's not thinking, maybe I should, you know, do something to not have this baby.
The animal has no concept that there's going to come a baby out of that behavior. There's absolutely zero awareness of this connection. So think of the leap.
So humans are the first.
Think of the leap in intelligence that had to happen in order for an animal, because, you know, that's what we are, in order for a human to make that leap of intelligence whereby it is now aware, while it is mating, that this behavior could lead to a pregnancy and to having a baby. That's an enormous leap in mental capacity because it means that the mind is able to maintain an image in this case, the image of a future event, the childbirth. The mind is able to maintain that image without that event being in the present. Now, that's amazing, because if something is not here now, in order for me to imagine it, I have to have a mind that can leave the perception and create something other than perception, create an image, create something that's not here, that's called abstraction. And we take that for granted because we do it all the time. In fact, our minds have a tendency to be lost in the abstraction of the past or the future. We get stuck there. I think it's called neurosis, right? When we are so concerned about what happened in the past that we forget we are not there. Well, animals have nothing of that. They are only here now, and the mind of an animal is not able to bring up an image and to hold it in the mind of something which is not right there in this moment, in this bubble that I call present.
Well, but if you say to a dog you want to go out, he hears those words and he imagines you're going to get the leash and he'll jump to it. So he's in another place.
Well, no, he's not in another place, but the animal knows, the brain of an animal can be trained by rewarding it into anticipation, but not with the mental image that we have. In other words, the animal does not hold in its mind the image of walking outside the house. The animal knows that there is a rewarding feeling when you say, let's go for a walk. The animal knows that something good is happening. But there is no image of the future. So it's a very, let's say that if the distance between now and the walk is 15 units, right? The animal can only make a distance of 1 unit. There's the distance between now and the reward. But the image of the walk does not come up.
So what makes us different than animals who are just said, do you want to go for a walk? What makes us have a different response? What makes us form relationships?
Well, we have an image. We have the capacity to create an image of something that's not there.
Now, where does that come from? That's our question. And this is what we're looking at today. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. We are talking about the differentiation between us and the animals and what the difference is. What are the gifts that we have as a species? And what are some of the curses? You know, I mean, animals don't worry. They don't.
That's right. They're not afraid of death.
And they're not afraid of death.
They're not preoccupied with...
their good looks.
Right.
No Botox for the average goat.
That's right. They have a lot less anxiety than we do, and they feel no guilt or shame. So all of those are the downsides of having a mind that can abstract. Guilt is a very good example, because, of course, if I can remember something I did that was not good, I can continue to feel guilt in relation to it. Well, and that, there's no such thing for an animal.
Right. They know that if they do something and they rip up your slipper, they're likely to get beaten because you condition them. You know, if you go over and hit them with a newspaper when they rip up your slipper, they're going to eventually say, this is not a good thing to do. Then they're going to rip up your slipper, and when they come home, you're going to see them skulking around with something that looks like shame because they have it connected to pain. They have it connected somehow. We want to talk about the humans. We want to talk about what made us different because, my friends, it is what we did with our minds that made us different, that it brings us to who we are today. What is the difference between us and the animals? What did we do with our precious mind? What did we say? What was it able to do? You look at a dog looking in a mirror. He looks in the mirror. Does he get excited by the other dog? No. Dogs don't get excited by mirror images. I wonder why, Roberta. Did anybody ever figure that out, why dogs don't get excited by...
Because they don't recognize themselves.
I know, but not even themselves. They don't even get angry at the dog in the mirror.
It's possible that they don't realize that there's an image there. Or that the image is not real enough. Because, see, for instance,
there's no smell, there's
dogs
no depth.
Don't really, they don't have a strong visual sense. They have a strong olfactory sense. So if there's something that moves in front of them that has no scent, most likely they don't think of it as an animal.
Right. The dogs and cats may not respond, but if you took a Siamese fighting fish and you put a mirror in front of it, it does perceive it, maybe because it's underwater.
Maybe,
you know,
it perceives movement.
It perceives the other. It will respond to another Siamese fighting fish more than it will respond to a guppy. It responds by flaring out and getting ready to fight.
Well, maybe because the eye of the fish is geared towards perceiving exactly the kind of movements that it does in the mirror.
Could be.
So if the fighting fish has a certain way of moving and it sees something in the mirror that does that, it's going to respond as if it were another fish. But still, it's not the same thing as having... as what happens to a human who looks at him or herself in a mirror.
And that's what we're going to get to. We want to get to the ability and what happens to a human when they look in a mirror that makes us so different than the animals, which is very interesting. And this is where it's going to bring us. This is the evolution of love, my friends. This is the evolution of the species. This is what separates us from the animals. And we're going to be getting to that in just a very short while. We're going to be looking at the single factor that seems to have been the differentiating factor. This is Armand Mill with Roberta Atti. We are looking at human sexuality and we're looking at human evolution. We're here on WBAI 99.5 FM. And we're looking at the differences in how maybe we can understand ourselves a little better. Which is our idea. The idea here is trying to get it so that you could, you know, understand it a little better. So maybe you'll be a little more kindly towards the other people in your species. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue with the answer to this question.
There is no wisdom to your freedom.
Thievery Corporation, T-H-I-E-V-A-R-Y, Thievery Corporation. Very interesting stuff. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. If you just tuned past and you said, what's that cool music? Well, you're listening to The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. I learned something a long time ago. I was working in learning and memory research, and we learned that when people are learning something, sometimes it's very difficult to learn too much at once. You know, if you're studying your geometry and you're studying it and then you come up with a new theorem and a new that you have to memorize, sometimes it's very difficult if you just continue. There's a thing called proactive inhibition, which is when you're learning something, it, if it's repetitious, will inhibit the next learning that you have. So what I learned was if you take your learning, and let's say you're trying to learn two things. You're trying to learn how to cook, chef-level cooking, and you're trying to learn how to do your geometry. The idea is to do something first and then do something very different, like practice music in between or try a recipe in between. Maybe recipes and geometry are too close together because there's a lot of math involved. It recommends that if you do something in between, it frees the mind so that you learn better both things. That's why we use music. I find that if people are engaged in a conversation and they're listening and they're learning and they hear what we're saying, that they're more receptive after a small musical break. A lot of people don't like the musical break. I like it. I like the effect of it. Armand DeMille here with Roberta Atti. We are talking about sexuality.
I want to say I like the music, Armand. You always have great music.
And I scour.
Mm-hmm, I know.
To find it. Because I think it's important.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about human behaviors, human sexuality. Now we're going to go into what differentiates humans from animals. Why do humans kiss? What is different between the way humans have sex and animals have sex? What's the feeling difference behind it? This is where the good stuff really comes in. Why do animals kiss? You know, kissing is such a funny, humans kiss, because kissing is such a funny thing. Animals don't kiss, do they, much?
There are some animals that have some behaviors that are similar to kissing, but they're not kissing like humans do. Even today, I was watching Molly and Bruiser kissing, and Molly is a huge Rhodesian Ridgeback. Bruiser is a tiny, I forget the breed, but it's one of those small dogs, beautiful dog. And Bruiser was licking the sides of Molly's mouth. Now, that resembles a kiss. And she was loving it. She was lying down, and she was letting him. And it looked so much like kissing, and yet it's a behavior whereby Bruiser was communicating submissiveness to Molly because he's much smaller. So by doing that, which resembles what a puppy would do to a parent, Bruiser was letting Molly know that he knows that in the hierarchical structure of dog society, she would be the leader. She would be the alpha. So there are animals that do something similar to kissing, but it's not for the same reasons as humans do.
And we're going to get to that because, you know, part of one of the things that you see is when an animal very often is licking another animal, which they'll very often go right to the hindquarters, you know, and smell the genitals. They're getting a lot of messages. They're getting a lot of chemical messages, which I don't think humans get when they kiss. They find out where you've been, what the condition of your body is, if you have any infections. They find all that out. So this is what the sniff communicates.
Although I do think that kissing does serve, to some extent, the purpose of allowing the nose to determine whether that person is a good match. And I think because in the kissing and in the inhaling the breath of the other person, you do get a message as to the chemistry of the other person.
We're going to have to do a call-in show on kissing. What do you get? What's a good kisser? What's not a good kisser?
I think that's a great show. I think people would love to talk about that. But I do think that for humans also, Armand, in kissing, there's some element of olfactory communication exchange, but not nearly as much as in with the animals.
Okay, so let's talk about what makes the animals and the humans different. What did the humans develop? Let's talk about a baby. A baby's in a crib. A baby is laying there. It's just born. The baby has no idea that it and its crib are any different. It believes it is part of this entity.
Now, the baby lives in a bubble, just like we were talking about a while ago. The dog lives in the bubble as a moment of existence, the present. The baby is like that. The baby's bubble of perception is such that the baby is one with everything else it perceives. It is not able to separate itself, the point that perceives, from everything else that it perceives.
Now, this means that if you were to take away a toy out of the crib, the baby may cry because you've taken part of it away.
Yes. It is not able to separate the toy from itself, so by removing something, the baby perceives as that's part of me, of course.
Now, this perception of being part of everything is the way most animals are. Most animals believe that they are in this, or most animals live in this bubble.
All animals.
All animals.
Yeah, all animals live in the moment of perception, the point of perception, as if the animal that perceives and the rest of it, of that moment, are one thing. Whereas for humans is a different story.
Humans developed a concept, an idea, that became the cornerstone of the human species, and it is the development of the self. Self-consciousness. Not self-conscious the way we know self-conscious, meaning you get ashamed if something doesn't look right or you do something wrong, but self-consciousness, consciousness of the self. Seeing the self as separate from other selves and from everything around you is the basic difference between humans and all animals.
And you know, Armand, this was an advancement in evolution, but it came with a price, and the price is maybe what we call the loss of the Garden of Eden, in a sense, because when the baby finally realizes, for instance, that mother is not part, that mother is not part of me, that mother is a separate being, and mother can leave whenever she wants to, and she does not come back when I scream. The realization that the self is separate from the rest of the world is very painful at first. And I think that for humans, evolutionary speaking, it hasn't been easy to accept that fact, to accept this capacity to separate oneself as I perceive everything else from everything else. It is difficult because it leaves me in a place where I am completely alone, Armand. If I'm a self unique and separate from everything else, I am also completely and utterly alone. No matter how much I can join with other people and socialize with other people and spend time with other people, ultimately I am myself, and the deeper the sense of self goes in the consciousness, the more alone I am going to feel and the more separate I'm going to feel, which is also a great source of existential despair. Now, animals and babies don't have that because there's no separateness in their minds from themselves and the rest of the world. But what is the advantage? The advantage is that if I can perceive myself not just as a point of perception, but as a point of perception separate from everything else, then I can also give the status of self to you, for instance.
Yes.
Okay. Yep, and there comes a difference now. Now enters love. Listen, friends, all human neurosis is the inability to differentiate between you and other people. All family problems. You know, when you insist they should be like me, when you have a fight with your husband or your wife and you say, why don't they do it the way, why don't they, why aren't they neat, why aren't they loose, why aren't they that? The inability to differentiate is where you believe that all self is you. That's what selfish is. Mm. Selfish is the inability to perceive your own self as a separate entity from the other selves. And the other selves have choices, just as you have choices.
That's right.
So now we develop this concept of self. Now you look in the mirror, and instead of just seeing some kind of a flat surface or seeing another animal in the mirror, you say, ah, that's me. And that's different than you. Now, when you kiss someone, you look at them face to face. Which is, by the way, you know, different than all animals have sex. All animals have sex and they don't see each other, right?
Right. Most animals, actually, as far as I know, all animals
mate
from behind, yes. And only humans mate face to face. And how different it is when you are mating and you look at this other self, and because you're able to abstract and to separate yourself from everything else, what you find in the mating and in this self-awareness is you create a bridge to the other, and also you create a sense of completeness, because now there is you and there is the other. And you also create the capacity to empathize, because now you can imagine what it feels like to be the other, and you know that you want to please the other, for instance. You want them to feel good, so you look to know what they like, because you want them to have that sense of good feeling. So you extend yourself, you create a bridge between you and the other, and this is the basis of all human relationship.
Armand DeMille here with Roberta Atti. We're talking about the difference between the humans and the animals and what the humans developed that was different than the animals, which is this self-awareness. We're talking about self-awareness, and you could see in our early childhood, you know, the terrible twos, when children are really young, they're kind of demanding as they live more in their own world and don't recognize the separateness of their parents. And then as a teenager, where you try to separate yourself from your parents, and there's some kind of a mandate that's saying, no, you know, on one level you're being attached, on another level you're trying to tear yourself away.
And then you form gangs, or you go out and you look for your peers to give you that sense of belonging to a group that you're losing that connection with your family, but you're looking for it.
Because of the development of this self is both welcomed and avoided.
Oh, it's terrifying, and it's also one of the greatest sources of despair, because as I realize that I'm alone as a separate self, I forever surrender something. I forever surrender my omnipotence. Right? I forever surrender the idea that I can control things. There are a lot of things that we had to surrender as a species when we accepted this deeper and deeper and deeper awareness of the self. But along with that surrender, I think Armand, came a great victory. And the victory is that as a point of perception, of self-awareness, meaning that I am me perceiving you, something else happens, that I also now have a whole world that I can observe as a self separate from it, and in which I can now find a reflection of me, and I can find the similarities between me and the rest of the world, and I can find where I am different, and I can find all this experience of life as a separate self in a world that is out there gives me a what is the essence of the human experience, which is the uniqueness of being and the capacity to reflect on the reality from a point of perception that is self-aware, as opposed to a point of perception that is just part of the world. And I said a lot, I realized, but I was really taken with the image of me looking at the stars, and
it
was just a poetic.
I understand. I understand, but let's get back to it. The idea is, I now perceive myself as separate, and now that I perceive myself as separate and I perceive you as separate, I understand there's different negotiations. I understand that things have to be different. I understand that I have to engage you, that you have a will of your own, that I have to in some way perpetuate your desire to be with me. I have to keep it going different than the animals do. It's not just building a bigger nest and staying the biggest animal so that you could fight off all the other animals. There is a relationship that humans have, and a relationship, this perception of separate selves, leads to the evolution of one of those difficult, difficult words, which I'm not going to go into trying to define, but the whole concept of love is based on the idea of a separate self. The idea to be able to feel the appreciation of another human being, to see them for who they are, to see them for what they are, and to have them see you for who you are and what you are, separate, different. And the more love there is, the less demand you're putting on the other person to change. And the less love there is, the more demand you're putting on the other person to change. You're saying, be like me, be like me. But when you stop doing that, love kind of develops even further. So what do humans have that's different than animals? I'm not going to say that animals don't love, but there's a quality of love, a love that is able to separate you from me, that makes me very different. Now everything I do, everything I move towards, my mating, my partnership, my coupleship, my entire world, what I'm doing is very different because I see myself as, number one, separate, and number two, you also perceive, and this is going to be a new complex thought, I perceive my mortality. See, animals don't know that they're going to die.
No.
No animal says to another animal, how old are you? Well, I'm 14. Well, you know, most of us only live to 15, so you're going to die someday. What are you putting in your will? Animals don't do that.
Because they live in that bubble, which is only the present. But the moment I become aware of myself, I also become aware of future and past and other moments in time that are not here at this moment. And something else that I was realizing as I was listening to you, Armand, is that along with the awareness of the self, there comes a sense of purpose, meaning that when I become aware of myself and I see myself as a unit of awareness, I not only am here being, but I also start to think about what do I need to do. There is a doing aspect question that comes in with the self-awareness. Humans have a need, have a purpose, have a need to do something. Humans are not content to just be in the moment. Because of this capacity to separate themselves from their environment and from other beings, and because of their capacity to abstract themselves with their minds, they also ask themselves, what do I need to do here? Why am I here? Is there a reason for me to be here? And then we start to create things because we start to think, well, maybe I should create a bicycle for myself. Maybe that's why I'm here. Or maybe I should cook dinner. Or maybe I should do this or that. So now creativity enters into the picture, also connected to self-awareness. And the purpose, I think, Brian Swim says, with humans, life becomes teleological. That's a big word that means with a purpose. Armand, I think you said it best. I think with humans, the purpose of life becomes, how do I express love to my family, to my mate, to my children? What makes that other individual, other than me, feel as good as I feel when I am loved? And how can I do that for that person? See, all of this thinking activity that goes along with self and that goes along with connecting to other selves creates the bridge that makes it possible to communicate love physically through mating, through kissing, through looking at a person's eyes, through all of the senses, and also through the mind and through speech.
Yeah. And that's the gift that humans have, the gifts that we have. I think you said something very beautiful. How do I get this other human to feel loved? Well, unfortunately, most humans are not really concerned with that. I think that's at the highest level of the human self-awareness.
You do? I think all humans, deep inside at some point, have some desire to communicate that.
They may, but don't look too closely at Iraq and what we're doing there when you think about that. You know what I mean? In other words, not all humans are really considering what's the effect of my behavior on your happiness.
I think we're going to have to do a show on distorted love.
Yes, I do. Hey, listen, it's the idea is, at its best, you want to know how the person you love can feel loved. Your capacity to do that is not going to be like every animal, which is, if I get her to feel loved, then she's going to give me sex, which is the biological mandate. But if I get her to feel loved, she's going to be happier, and I am a separate human being than you are, and I would like you to be happy. Just as I'd like myself to be happy, a human difference, a very human difference, based on a convoluted, very complex brain, but really one of the gifts. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. We have to be going, my friends, and we'll continue with much more of this. Thank you for being with us. If you wanted a copy of today's program, well, you would call 212-757-4488, 212-757-4488. If you wanted to reach Roberta Atti, you would do so at robertaforhealth, with the number 4, at AOL.com. And take a look at our website, thepositivemind.com, one word. Hey, we'll be back with you soon, my friends. It's been a lot of fun. Here's a little more of Thievery Corporation.
Let's go.